We have one other co-author here in the crowd, so I want to acknowledge Stacy. I also want to acknowledge our content experts who helped us develop the educational strategy. One of them is up here with me, Melvi Shahid. We interviewed three clinicians and three survivors to develop our educational materials. Community organizations helped us do our pilot testing and pre-testing of the educational strategy, and I also wanted to acknowledge we got the funding as a supplementary grant to the Program to Eliminate Cancer Disparities, Siteman Cancer Institute's NCI grant. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Melvi to set us up.
Good morning. My name is Melvi Shahid. I am the son of a colon cancer victim. Also, I'm a happily married husband, father, grandfather, and I'm a construction trade small business owner. But most importantly, I'm a prostate cancer survivor. When I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, I felt a sense of hopelessness and fear because I thought I was going to die. And then I recall something that my mother taught me. She said that God can do anything but fail. So on my knees, I begged for my life. I asked God to give me a second chance to heal my body. And if he would do that, then I would spend my life in service to fighting this disease. I truly feel that this was a calling from God. So 3 years later, all the signs indicated that God and I have both kept our promise. I'm free of prostate cancer, and I have moved on to found the Empowerment Network, which is a federally recognized 501c3 organization under the Missouri State Statute. At the outset, there were only two of us. And in 1 year's time, our survivors grew from two men to over 125 prostate cancer survivors. This has not been an easy task, and in my struggles with prostate cancer, I came to realize that there was a lack of information, a lack of education, a lack of PSA testing and screening support, and cultural disparities confronting populations of African Americans 35 years and older across the St. Louis metropolitan area. It became very clear to me as the direction that I must take as a prostate cancer survivor and a prostate cancer advocate. Prostate cancer is the most frequent cancer and the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in men. Disparities are greater for prostate cancer than any other cancer. Incidence is 50% higher among African American men, and mortality more than doubles. The mission of the Empowerment Network is to heighten awareness, increase PSA testing and screening, provide informational resource services, support, volunteerism, and collaborative research that give rise to the gap of disparity that the uninsured and the uninsured African American males and their families encounter when they encounter with a prostate cancer diagnosis. Now, there are many programs that the Empowerment Network is involved in, so I won't go through every program for the sake of time, but one of the programs that I really like to highlight in our outreach is our Speakers Bureau, and they are the ones in our groups that go out and do speaking at the health fairs and the churches and the institution, the media outlets, community events. And these are a group of guys that have been empowered throughout our support group with the courage to go out here and educate the public with their journey, with their presence, as they go out here and educate at the community settings. Thank you for allowing me to present my overview in the community outreach component of this study, and we'll move on to Dr. Bray with the academic research component. Thank you.
There are a couple of things that led to the study. One was I moved to St. Louis about 8 years ago and started doing some needs assessment work around prostate cancer communication in the African American community, and I found that there were disparate efforts, health fairs, and groups that were going out and doing education about prostate cancer, but they were kind of disconnected and not coordinated. So one of the key results from that early needs assessment was the need to come up with a kind of a common core content for prostate cancer education. So that's one of the things I sought to do. Many of you are also probably familiar with controversy around prostate cancer screening and the requirement for promoting informed decision making. And some of the leaders in the field have talked about the challenge of trying to translate an informed decision making paradigm from a clinical setting to a community setting. So those are kind of the two impetuses for the study. So in this effort, I wanted to design with collaborators a curriculum, a short presentation that could be used by community groups who were reaching out to men in the community to provide information about prostate cancer and about prostate cancer screening. As part of that, I wanted to explore the issues around informed decision making in community setting. And I also, having met Melvi and knowing some of the success of work in particularly breast cancer outreach, trying to explore the contributions of survivors in this work. So a couple of different steps just to give you some background. I acknowledged my six content experts at the start. These were all six individuals who had, for varying periods of time, been involved in outreach education in the community. Again, there were three clinicians, two physicians, one RN, and then three survivors who had, again, had been doing outreach education. So I interviewed them to find out what is it that they convey to their audiences. And that became sort of the beginning of the outline for our presentation. We developed an educational outreach strategy, effectively a PowerPoint presentation. In the end, we produced it in two different forms. One was a PowerPoint presentation like this, but the other one was we converted it into a little flip chart, which is sort of an 11 by 17 version, where on the side that faces the audience, they see the image of the PowerPoint. The back the speaker could use has the notes version. I'm sure you're all familiar with PowerPoint, so you have the notes version, which kind of gives the talking points for the educator. So that became that was useful in smaller settings where you have a half dozen people or a small group, or they don't have the technology to do PowerPoint, so this is what they could use. We pre-tested it in a couple of small discussion groups. We revised the educational outreach, and then we evaluated it using a quasi-experiment. Very quickly, the content of, because I didn't include any of the slides from the presentation itself, but basically the outline of the presentation was some background about the prostate, to begin with, a little bit about prostate cancer, issues around disparities, screening options, and then what we found as we were doing the second review with our content experts, because they reviewed the PowerPoint a couple of times in this process. In the early version, and this is consistent with prostate cancer educational outreach, they included a fair amount of information about treatment options. When we went back to them after the pretest, we ended up backing off on the treatment information on the grounds that this was really a presentation about screening. So the bottom line for the presentation was, get screened. If you have a positive result, talk to your doctor. So we really emphasized the conversation with the physician as the end point for that presentation. Okay. So the quasi-experiment was to compare survivor educators with health educators. Some of our measures are knowledge, beliefs about barriers, beliefs about benefits. The self-efficacy was related to decision-making. So those were our main outcomes as far as the informed decision-making piece. Then we also asked about responses to the different educators to see whether the survivors came across differently for the participants. Now, when we did the analysis, however, you'll see what I've done here is we had a small sample. We had about 60 people in the sample. So I was glad to see Dr. Rovito had about the same sample size, so I don't feel too bad. As you commented, it's very hard to do this kind of research in community settings. But for the informed decision-making outcomes, I'm just comparing my pre and post And then for the groups, I'm really just looking at the presenter appeal variables. So you can see that we have a bit of a bump in knowledge. We had a reduction in perceived barriers. We had an increase in decision self-efficacy, and all those were significant. I included the intention measure because it's basically no difference, and everybody who was coming to these events, these are educational events about prostate cancer screening, the guys are coming there in part to get screened. So that's hence no difference on that. Also, just to note that there were no differences for subjective norms and perceived benefits. Then it was interesting to find with the group comparison that the survivor educators fared better. Actually, I should comment, the cultural appropriateness was really commenting on the presentation itself, which I think, like the colorectal cancer screening piece, it was kind of culturally specific and designed for African-American audiences. But the survivor educators did better as far as appeal of the presenter, identification with the presenter, and liking. So we got a good result there and some indication that our survivor educators are good presenters for this kind of content. There were no differences, however, for expertise, trust, similarity. So the health educators also have some credibility, clearly, in terms of being providing education on this in this area. So just to summarize, so we had some significant increases in knowledge, beliefs about barriers and risk, decision self-efficacy, the presentation was perceived as culturally appropriate, and the survivor educators were more appealing overall. So again, for a small pilot study, we got some encouraging results for the effectiveness of this curriculum. So some quick conclusions. I'll start off, and then I wanted to invite Melvi back to sort of comment from the community perspective too. So again, this isn't particularly brilliant, but we developed an educational strategy, and we managed to get some changes in knowledge. We shifted beliefs about barriers a little bit. Importantly, I think from the decision-making standpoint, we did have some success with confidence about decision-making, and this had partly to do with perceptions that they had sufficient information to make an informed decision about screening. And the survivor educators had a better reception. Melvi, you want to comment a little bit about sort of from TEN's perspective?
From TEN's perspective, what we've noticed is that we are changing the conversation of prostate cancer in the community, and you change the conversation by engaging men in conversation. So as we do the health fairs and the barbershop tours, and we go into the different barbershops throughout the city of St. Louis, and we talk to men about prostate cancer, and we start exchanging with them the different ideas that we have come up with, they seem to be a lot more receptive to getting screened and getting tested. And I think that has been a great reward for the Empowerment Network, because now we're in the city of St. Louis, they're talking about prostate cancer more and more and more. That's the community perspective.
Should comment, I mentioned that I did this needs assessment work at the beginning, and there were kind of scattershot groups doing this kind of work, and with Melvi's leadership, it's kind of like pulling teeth sometimes, getting people to these events, but the Empowerment Network is remarkably successful. Melvi manages to pack them in. So we get a really good result, and the Speakers Bureau, which is run by his co-founder, Isidore Wayne, they do on the order of 4 to 10 presentations a month in a variety of community settings, and they go back quarterly to the same location. So there really is sort of the level of commentary has really increased. So I've always really admired Melvi's work in that regard. So, and we have a few more minutes for questions, I think. Marla?
First of all, congratulations on doing something where you're looking at lay health educators versus sort of more traditional lay health educators, because I think that's really interesting, and I think it's easy to get lost sometimes when people talk about community work. But I had a question really about
Well, you're not alone. And if I've been losing sleep about anything over the last few years, it's trying to negotiate that. So Melvi and I have spent the last 24 hours, it feels like, talking about it. And so I was telling Ellen actually also that we're trying to figure out how to negotiate this. So here's kind of my take on it. As I mentioned at the beginning, the informed decision-making paradigm really comes out of a clinical setting. And so when applied to prostate cancer screening, the protocols would have you walk through all of the potential outcomes of screening. So you get a negative result, good for you, come back next year. If you get a positive result, you're going to embark on a sequence of increasingly more complicated decisions about maybe you do some further PSA work, or they talk about PSA trajectory. You may think about getting a biopsy or 3 or 4. We know some of our survivors who it's taken several biopsies before they actually got a diagnosis and their PSA kept climbing. And then finally, some of them will get a diagnosis, and then they're going to have to make a choice about, is it watchful waiting, is it radiation, is it surgery, the variety of options. And our clinician content experts said for a 10 or 15 minute presentation, we can't walk through all those options. So this is where we're kind of pushing back. And what my sense now, sort of the argument that I'm coming to, is that those very difficult decisions around, because it's really versus, it's watchful waiting versus some kind of a treatment decision. And that's a decision that can, should, and hopefully does get made in a conversation, in a shared decision-making, informed decision-making process in the doctor's office. So this is where we're kind of going against the grain here, and I anticipate some pushback from the epidemiologists on this, because I know exactly that's what the requirements for population-level recommendations for screening have to do with efficacy for survival benefit. And what we're talking about here is going into community settings and individuals making choices. So we think about those, instead of walking those options all the way down to a treatment decision, which will inevitably be made later anyway, if it's necessary, to look at it more closely. So the options, the short-term outcomes are, you have a negative result, that's great, or you have a positive result, talk to your doctor. So that we're setting up that informed decision making, and I think putting the onus of that very difficult decision, watchful waiting versus treatment, in the doctor's office, where it really can be a shared decision. We also know, there's lots of research that suggests that those very difficult decisions around treatment are also very fraught and tend to be not very informed and not necessarily very independent. We know, for example, that that physicians get PSA screening at a rate much higher than the general public. So there's all kinds of kind of contradictory information. So when we're dealing with a community setting, there is a sort of a persuasive aspect to it, but the end point is really to encourage people to talk to their physicians. And what Melvi has commented to me is that what's important for the population that we're working with, these are men who may not be inclined to visit the doctor in the first place, this becomes kind of a foot in the door for them, and they go to get their PSA screening, and they're in the clinic, and they end up following up with getting their eyes examined or getting hypertension screening. So it's kind of an opportunity to get them in the system as well, which we think is a positive outcome. You got a follow-up though.
Whether or not someone should be screened, and certainly concerns when people get screened without even, they end up
Right. My sense is that, because that's exactly right, and the challenge for me is that do we put the onus of that whole work on community organizations, or do we put it in the doctor's offices, where I think the decisions are also, again, equally complicated and sometimes ill-informed, too. So, I mean, I say let's push it on the doctors, too, because I think, you know, doctors are inclined to, they're inclined to promote treatment, too. So I think if we move in that direction to have, or surgeons are inclined to promote surgery, and radiation oncologists are inclined to promote radiation, right? So to try and encourage them to really look at the evidence, and you know, from a communication perspective, I think the informed decision-making paradigm is kind of an ideal type that is never reached in the best of circumstances, or very, very exceptionally, and that we really need to try and take. So what we've tried to do is take this ideal type and marry it with sort of a pragmatic reality of the community setting and how we can try to be effective in the community setting. Yeah. There are some real system issues about trying to enhance shared decision-making in the community setting and the clinical setting. I know we're out of time, and the next audience is going to be coming in. So we can stick around outside if there are any further questions. Thank you.